Tender is the Night, Disc 11.
7. But she went to the beach with Dick next morning, with a renewal of her apprehension that Dick was contriving at some desperate solution. Since the evening on Golding's yacht, she had sensed what was going on. So delicately balanced was she, between an old foothold that had always guaranteed her security, and the imminence of a leap from which she must alight changed in the very chemistry of blood and muscle, that she did not dare bring the matter into the true forefront of consciousness. The figures of Dick and herself, mutating, undefined, appeared as spooks caught up into a fantastic dance. For months, every word had seemed to have an overtone of some other meaning, soon to be resolved under circumstances that Dick would determine. Though this state of mind was perhaps more hopeful, the long years of sheer being had had an enlivening effect on the parts of her nature that early illness had killed, that Dick had not reached, through no fault of his, but simply because no one nature can extend entirely inside another. It was still disquieting. The most unhappy aspect of their relations was Dick's growing indifference, at present personified by too much drink. Nicole did not know whether she was to be crushed or spared. Dick's voice, throbbing with insincerity, confused the issue. She couldn't guess how he was going to behave next upon the tortuously slow unrolling of the carpet, nor what would happen at the end, at the moment of the leap. For what might occur thereafter, she had no anxiety. She suspected that that would be the lifting of a burden, an unblinding of eyes. Nicole had been designed for change, for flight, with money as fins and wings. The new state of things would be no more than if a racing chassis, concealed for years under the body of a family limousine, should be stripped to its original self. Nicole could feel the fresh breeze already, the wrench it was she feared, and the dark manner of its coming. The divers went out on the beach with her white suit and his white trunks, very white against the color of their bodies. Nicole saw Dick peer about for the children among the confused shapes and shadows of many umbrellas, and as his mind temporarily left her, ceasing to grip her, she looked at him with detachment, and decided that he was seeking his children not protectively but for protection. Probably it was the beach he feared, like a deposed ruler secretly visiting an old court. She had come to hate his world with its delicate jokes and politenesses, forgetting that for many years it was the only world open to her. Let him look at it, his beach, perverted now to the tastes of the tasteless. He could search it for a day and find no stone of the Chinese wall he had once erected around it, no footprint of an old friend. For a moment Nicole was sorry it was so. Remembering the glass he had raked out of the old trash heap, remembering the sailor trunks and sweaters they had bought in a Nice back street, garments that afterward ran through a vogue in silk among the Paris couturiers, remembering the simple little French girls climbing on the breakwaters crying, dites donc, like birds, and the ritual of the morning time, the quiet, restful extraversion towards sea and sun, many inventions of his buried deeper than the sand under the span of so few years. Now the swimming place was a club, though, like the international society it represented, it would be hard to say who was not admitted. Nicole hardened again as Dick knelt on the straw mat and looked about for Rosemary. Her eyes followed his, searching among the new paraphernalia, the trapezes over the water, the swinging rings, the portable bathhouses, the floating towers, the searchlights from last night's fetes, the modernistic buffet, white with a hackneyed motif of endless handlebars. The water was almost the last place he looked for Rosemary. because few people swam any more in that blue paradise. Children and one exhibitionistic valet who punctuated the morning with spectacular dives from a 50-foot rock. Most of Ghos's guests stripped the concealing pajamas from their flabbiness only for a short hangover dip at 1 o'clock. "There she is," Nicole remarked. She watched Dick's eyes following Rosemary's track from raft to raft. But the sigh that rocked out of her bosom was something left over from 5 years ago. "Let's swim out and speak to Rosemary," he suggested. "You go. We'll both go." She struggled a moment against his pronouncement, but eventually they swam out together, tracing Rosemary by the school of little fish who followed her, taking their dazzle from her, the shining spoon of a trout hook. Nicole stayed in the water while Dick hoisted himself up beside Rosemary, and the two sat dripping and talking, exactly as if they had never loved or touched each other. Rosemary was beautiful. Her youth was a shock to Nicole, who rejoiced, however, that the young girl was less slender by a hairline than herself. Nicole swam around in little rings, listening to Rosemary, who was acting amusement, joy, and expectation, more confident than she had been 5 years ago. "I miss Mother so, but she's meeting me in Paris Monday." "5 years ago you came here," said Dick. "And what a funny little thing you were in one of those hotel peignoirs." "How you remember things. You always did, and always the nice things." Nicole saw the old game of flattery beginning again, and she dove underwater, coming up again to hear. "I'm going to pretend it's 5 years ago, and I'm a girl of 18 again. You could always make me feel some, kind of happy way, you and Nicole. I feel as if you're still on the beach there under one of those umbrellas, the nicest people I'd ever known, maybe ever will." Swimming away, Nicole saw that the cloud of Dick's heartsickness had lifted a little as he began to play with Rosemary, bringing out his old expertness with people, a tarnished object of art. She guessed that with a drink or so he would have done his stunts on the swinging rings for her, fumbling through stunts he had once done with ease. She noticed that this summer, for the first time, he avoided high diving. Later, as she dodged her way from raft to raft, Dick overtook her. "Some of Rosemary's friends have a speedboat, the one out there. Do you want an aquaplane? I think it would be amusing." Remembering that once he could stand on his hands on a chair at the end of a board, she indulged him as she might have indulged Lanier. Last summer on the Zugersee, they had played at that pleasant water game, and Dick had lifted a 200-pound man from the board onto his shoulders and stood up. But women marry all their husbands' talents, and, naturally, afterwards, are not so impressed with them as they may keep up the pretense of being. Nicole had not even pretended to be impressed, though she had said yes to him, and yes, I thought so, too. She knew, though, that he was somewhat tired, that it was only the closeness of Rosemary's exciting youth that prompted the impending effort. She had seen him draw the same inspiration from the new bodies of her children, and she wondered coldly if he would make a spectacle of himself. The divers were older than the others in the boat. The young people were polite, deferential, but Nicole felt an undercurrent of, "Who are these numbers, anyhow?" And she missed Dick's easy talent of taking control of situations and making them all right. He had concentrated on what he was going to try to do. The motor throttled down 200 yards from shore, and one of the young men dove flat over the edge. He swam at the aimless, twisting board, steadied it, climbed slowly to his knees on it, then got on his feet as the boat accelerated. Leaning back, he swung his light vehicle ponderously from side to side in slow, breathless arcs that rode the trailing side swell at the end of each swing. In the direct wake of the boat, he let go his rope, balanced for a moment, then backflipped into the water, disappearing like a statue of glory, and reappearing as an insignificant head while the boat made the circle back to him. Nicole refused her turn. Then Rosemary rowed the board neatly and conservatively, with facetious cheers from her admirers. Three of them scrambled egotistically for the honor of pulling her into the boat, managing, among them, to bruise her knee and hip against the side. "Now you, doctor," said the Mexican at the wheel. Dick and the last young man dove over the side and swam to the board. Dick was going to try his lifting trick, and Nicole began to watch with smiling scorn. This physical showing off for Rosemary irritated her most of all. When the men had ridden long enough to find their balance, Dick knelt, and putting the back of his neck in the other man's crotch, found the rope through his legs and slowly began to rise. The people in the boat, watching closely, saw that he was having difficulties. He was on one knee. The trick was to straighten all the way up in the same motion with which he left his kneeling position. He rested for a moment, then his face contracted as he put his heart into the strain and lifted. The board was narrow. The man, though weighing less than 150, was awkward with his weight and grabbed clumsily at Dick's head. When, with a last wrenching effort of his back, Dick stood upright, the board slid sidewise and the pair toppled into the sea. In the boat, Rosemary exclaimed, "Wonderful! They almost had it!" But as they came back to the swimmers, Nicole watched for a sight of Dick's face. It was full of annoyance, as she expected, because he had done the thing with ease only 2 years ago. The second time he was more careful. He rose a little, testing the balance of his burden, settled down again on his knee, then, grunting alley-oop, began to rise, but before he could really straighten out, his legs suddenly buckled and he shoved the board away with his feet to avoid being struck as they fell off. This time when the baby Gar came back, it was apparent to all the passengers that he was angry. "Do you mind if I try that once more?" he called, treading water. "We almost had it then." "Sure, go ahead." To Nicole he looked white around the gills, and she cautioned him. "Don't you think that's enough for now?" He didn't answer. The first partner had had plenty and was hauled over the side. The Mexican driving the motorboat obligingly took his place. He was heavier than the first man. As the boat gathered motion, Dick rested for a moment, belly down on the board. Then he got beneath the man and took the rope, and his muscles flexed as he tried to rise. He could not rise. Nicole saw him shift his position and strain upward again, but at the instant when the weight of his partner was full upon his shoulders, he became immovable. He tried again, lifting an inch, 2 inches. Nicole felt the sweat glands of her forehead open as she strained with him. Then he was simply holding his ground. Then he collapsed back down on his knees with a smack, and they went over, Dick's head barely missing a kick of the board. "Hurry back," Nicole called to the driver. Even as she spoke, she saw him slide underwater, and she gave a little cry, but he came up again and turned on his back, and Chateau swam near to help. It seemed forever till the boat reached them, but when they came alongside at last, and Nicole saw Dick floating, exhausted and expressionless, alone with the water and the sky, her panic changed suddenly to contempt. "We'll help you up, doctor. Get his foot. All right, now, all together." Dick sat panting and looking at nothing. "I knew you shouldn't have tried it," Nicole could not help saying. "He tired himself the first 2 times," said the Mexican. "It was a foolish thing," Nicole insisted. Rosemary, tactfully, said nothing. After a minute, Dick got his breath, panting, "I couldn't have lifted a paper doll that time." An explosive little laugh relieved the tension caused by his failure. They were all attentive to Dick as he disembarked at the dock, but Nicole was annoyed. Everything he did annoyed her now. She sat with Rosemary under an umbrella while Dick went to the buffet for a drink. He returned presently with some sherry for them. The first drink I ever had was with you, Rosemary said, and with a spurt of enthusiasm she added, Oh, I'm so glad to see you and know you're all right. I was worried. Her sentence broke as she changed direction. That maybe you wouldn't be. Did you hear I'd gone into a process of deterioration? Oh, no, I simply just heard you'd changed, and I'm glad to see with my own eyes it isn't true.
It is true, Dick answered, sitting down with him. The change came a long way back, but at first it didn't show. The manner remains intact for some time after the morale cracks.
Do you practice on the Riviera? Rosemary demanded hastily.
It'd be a good ground to find likely specimens. He nodded here and there at the people milling about in the golden sand. Great candidates. Notice our old friend Mrs. Abrams, playing Duchess to Mary North's queen. Don't get jealous about it. Think of Mrs. Abrams' long climb up the back stairs of the Ritz on her hands and knees, and all the carpet dust she had to inhale.
Rosemary interrupted him. But is that really Mary North? She was regarding a woman sauntering in their direction, followed by a small group who behaved as if they were accustomed to being looked at. When they were 10 feet away, Mary's glance flickered fractionally over the divers, one of those unfortunate glances that indicate to the glanced upon that they have been observed but are to be overlooked, the sort of glance that neither the divers nor Rosemary Hoyt had ever permitted themselves to throw at anyone in their lives. Dick was amused when Mary perceived Rosemary, changed her plans, and came over. She spoke to Nicole with pleasant heartiness, nodded unsmilingly to Dick as if he were somewhat contagious, whereupon he bowed in ironic respect as she greeted Rosemary.
"I heard you were here. For how long?"
"Until tomorrow," Rosemary answered. She, too, saw how Mary had walked through the divers to talk to her, and a sense of obligation kept her unenthusiastic. No, she could not dine tonight. Mary turned to Nicole, her manner indicating affection blended with pity. "How are the children?" she asked. They came up at the moment, and Nicole gave ear to a request that she overrule the governess on a swimming point.
"No," Dick answered for her. "What Mademoiselle says must go."
Agreeing that one must support delegated authority, Nicole refused their request, whereupon Mary, who in the manner of an Anita Loos heroine had dealings only with fait accompli, who indeed could not have housebroken a French poodle puppy, regarded Dick as though he were guilty of a most flagrant bullying. Dick, chafed by the tiresome performance, inquired with mock solicitude, "How are your children and their aunts?" Mary did not answer. She left them, first draping a sympathetic hand over Lanier's reluctant head. After she had gone, Dick said, "When I think of the time I spent working over her..."
"I like her," said Nicole.
Dick's bitterness had surprised Rosemary, who had thought of him as all-forgiving, all-comprehending. Suddenly she recalled what it was she had heard about him. In conversation with some State Department people on the boat, Europeanized Americans who had reached a position where they could scarcely have been said to belong to any nation at all, at least not to any great power, though perhaps to a Balkan-like state composed of similar citizens, the name of the ubiquitously renowned Baby Warren had occurred, and it was remarked that Baby's younger sister had thrown herself away on a dissipated doctor. "He's not received anywhere anymore," the woman said. The phrase disturbed Rosemary, though she could not place the divers as living in any relation to society where such a fact, if fact it was, could have any meaning. Yet the hint of a hostile and organized public opinion rang in her ears. "He's not received anywhere anymore." She pictured Dick climbing the steps of a mansion, presenting cards, and being told by a butler, "We're not receiving you anymore."
then proceeding down an avenue only to be told the same thing by the countless other butlers of countless ambassadors, ministers, chargés d'affaires. Nicole wondered how she could get away. She guessed that Dick, stung into alertness, would grow charming and would make Rosemary respond to him. Sure enough, in a moment his voice managed to qualify everything unpleasant he had said. "Mary's all right. She's done very well, but it's hard to go on liking people who don't like you." Rosemary, falling into line, swayed toward Dick and crooned, "Oh, you're so nice. I can't imagine anybody not forgiving you anything, no matter what you did to them." Then, feeling that her exuberance had transgressed on Nicole's rights, she looked at the sand exactly between them. "I wanted to ask you both what you thought of my latest pictures, if you saw them." Nicole said nothing, having seen one of them and thought little about it. "It'll take a few minutes to tell you," Dick said. "Let's suppose that Nicole says to you that Lanier is ill. What do you do in life? What does anyone do? They act. Face, voice, words. The face shows sorrow, the voice shows shock, the words show sympathy." "Yes, I understand." "But in the theater, no. In the theater, all the best comedians have built up their reputations by burlesquing the correct emotional responses, fear and love and sympathy."
"I see."
Yet she did not quite see. Losing the thread of it, Nicole's impatience increased as Dick continued. "The danger to an actress is in responding. Again, let's suppose that somebody told you your lover is dead. In life, you'd probably go to pieces, but on the stage, you're trying to entertain. The audience can do the responding for themselves. First, the actress has lines to follow. Then she has to get the audience's attention back on herself, away from the murdered Chinese or whatever the thing is. So she must do something unexpected. If the audience thinks the character is hard, she goes soft on them. If they think she's soft, she goes hard. You go all out of character, you understand?"
"I don't, quite," admitted Rosemary. "How do you mean, out of character?"
"You do the unexpected thing until you've maneuvered the audience back from the objective fact to yourself. Then you slide into character again." Nicole could stand no more. She stood up sharply, making no attempt to conceal her impatience. Rosemary, who had been for a few minutes half-conscious of this, turned in a conciliatory way to Topsy. "Would you like to be an actress when you grow up? I think you'd make a fine actress." Nicole stared at her deliberately, and in her grandfather's voice said, slow and distinct, "It's absolutely out to put such ideas in the heads of other people's children. Remember, we may have quite different plans for them." She turned sharply to Dick. "I'm going to take the car home. I'll send Michelle for you and the children."
"You haven't driven for months," he protested.
"I haven't forgotten how." Without a glance at Rosemary, whose face was responding violently, Nicole left the umbrella. In the bathhouse, she changed to pajamas, her expression still hard as a plaque, but as she turned into the road of arched pines and the atmosphere changed, with a squirrel's flight on a branch, a wind nudging at the leaves, a cock splitting distant air with a creep of sunlight transpiring through the immobility, then the voices of the beach receded, Nicole relaxed and felt new and happy. Her thoughts were clear as good bells. She had a sense of being cured and in a new way. Her ego began blooming like a great rich rose as she scrambled back along the labyrinths in which she had wandered for years. She hated the beach, resented the places where she had played planet to Dick's son. "Why, I'm almost complete," she thought. "I'm practically standing alone, without him." And like a happy child, wanting the completion as soon as possible, and knowing vaguely that Dick had planned for her to have it, she lay on her bed as soon as she got home, and wrote Tommy Barbon
in Nice. A short, provocative letter. But that was for the daytime. Toward evening, with the inevitable diminution of nervous energy, her spirits flagged, and the arrows flew a little in the twilight. She was afraid of what was in Dick's mind. Again, she felt that a plan underlay his current actions, and she was afraid of his plans. They worked well, and they had an all-inclusive logic about them which Nicole was not able to command. She had somehow given over the thinking to him. And in his absences, her every action seemed automatically governed by what he would like, so that now she felt inadequate to match her intentions against his. Yet think she must. She knew at last the number on the dreadful door of fantasy, the threshold to the escape that was no escape. She knew that for her the greatest sin, now and in the future, was to delude herself. It had been a long lesson, but she had learned it. Either you think, or else others have to think for you and take power from you, pervert and discipline your natural tastes, civilize and sterilize you. They had a tranquil supper, with Dick drinking much beer and being cheerful with the children in the dusky room. Afterward he played some Schubert songs and some new jazz from America that Nicole hummed in her harsh, sweet contralto over his shoulder. "Thank you, Father, thank you, Mother, thanks for meeting up with one another." "I don't like that one," Dick said, starting to turn the page. "Oh, play it," she exclaimed. "Am I going through the rest of life flinching at the word Father? Thank the horse that pulled the buggy that night. Thank you both for being just a bit tight." Later they sat with the children on the Moorish roof and watched the fireworks of two casinos, far apart, far down on the shore. It was lonely and sad to be so empty-hearted toward each other. Next morning, back from shopping in Cannes, Nicole found a note saying that Dick had taken the small car and gone up into Provence for a few days by himself. Even as she read it, the phone rang. It was Tommy Barbon from Monte Carlo, saying that he had received her letter and was driving over. She felt her lips' warmth in the receiver as she welcomed his coming. Eight. She bathed and anointed herself, and covered her body with a layer of powder while her toes crunched another pile on a bath towel. She looked microscopically at the lines of her flanks, wondering how soon the fine, slim edifice would begin to sink squat and earthward. "In about 6 years, but now I'll do. In fact, I'll do as well as anyone I know." She was not exaggerating. The only physical disparity between Nicole at present and the Nicole of 5 years before was simply that she was no longer a young girl. But she was enough ridden by the current youth worship, the moving pictures with their myriad faces of girl children, blandly represented as carrying on the work and wisdom of the world, to feel a jealousy of youth. She put on the first ankle-length day dress that she had owned for many years, and crossed herself reverently with Chanel 16. When Tommy drove up at 1 o'clock, she had made her person into the trimmest of gardens. How good to have things like this, to be worshipped again, to pretend to have a mystery. She had lost two of the great arrogant years in the life of a pretty girl. Now she felt like making up for them. She greeted Tommy as if he were one of many men at her feet, walking ahead of him instead of beside him as they crossed the garden toward the market umbrella. Attractive women of 19 and of 29 are alike in their breezy confidence.
On the contrary, the exigent womb of the 20s does not pull the outside world centripetally around itself. The former are ages of insolence, comparable the one to a young cadet, the other to a fighter strutting after combat. But whereas a girl of 19 draws her confidence from a surfeit of attention, a woman of 29 is nourished on subtler stuff. Desirous, she chooses her aperitifs wisely, or content, she enjoys the caviar of potential power. Happily, she does not seem, in either case, to anticipate the subsequent years when her insight will often be blurred by panic, by the fear of stopping or the fear of going on. But on the landings of 19 or 29, she is pretty sure that there are no bears in the hall. Nicole did not want any vague spiritual romance. She wanted an affair. She wanted a change. She realized, thinking with Dick's thoughts, that from a superficial view it was a vulgar business to enter, without emotion, into an indulgence that menaced all of them. On the other hand, she blamed Dick for the immediate situation, and honestly thought that such an experiment might have a therapeutic value. All summer she had been stimulated by watching people do exactly what they were tempted to do and pay no penalty for it. Moreover, in spite of her intention of no longer lying to herself, she preferred to consider that she was merely feeling her way, and that at any moment she could withdraw. In the light shade, Tommy caught her up in his white duck arms and pulled her around to him, looking at her eyes. "Don't move," he said. "I'm going to look at you a great deal from now on." There was some scent on his hair, a faint aura of soap from his white clothes. Her lips were tight, not smiling, and they both simply looked for a moment. "Do you like what you see?" she murmured. "Parle français." "Very well." And she asked again in French, "Do you like what you see?" He pulled her closer. "I like whatever I see about you." He hesitated. "I thought I knew your face, but it seems there are some things I didn't know about it. When did you begin to have white crook's eyes?" She broke away, shocked and indignant, and cried in English, "Is that why you wanted to talk French?" Her voice quieted as the butler came with sherry. "So you could be offensive more accurately?" She parked her small seat violently on the cloth of silver chair cushion. "I have no mirror here," she said, again in French but decisively. "But if my eyes have changed, it's because I'm well again. And being well, perhaps I've gone back to my true self. I suppose my grandfather was a crook, and I'm a crook by heritage, so there we are. Does that satisfy your logical mind?" He scarcely seemed to know what she was talking about. "Where's Dick? Is he lunching with us?" Seeing that his remark had meant comparatively little to him, she suddenly laughed away its effect. "Dick's on a tour," she said. "Rosemary Hoyt turned up, and either they're together, or she upset him so much that he wants to go away and dream about her." "You know, you're a little complicated after all." "Oh, no," she assured him hastily. "No, I'm not really. I'm just a whole lot of different, simple people." Marius brought out melon and an ice pail, and Nicole, thinking irresistibly about her crook's eyes, did not answer. He gave one an entire nut to crack, this man, instead of giving it in fragments to pick at for meat. "Why didn't they leave you in your natural state?" Tommy demanded presently. "You are the most dramatic person I have known." She had no answer. "All this taming of women," he scoffed. "In any society there are certain—" She felt Dick's ghost prompting at her elbow, but she subsided at Tommy's overtone. "I've brutalized many men into shape, but I wouldn't take a chance on half the number of women."
especially this kind bullying. What good does it do anybody, you or him or anybody?
Her heart leaped and then sank faintly with a sense of what she owed Dick.
I suppose I've got... You've got too much money, he said impatiently. That's the crux of the matter. Dick can't beat that.
She considered while the melons were removed. What do you think I ought to do? For the first time in 10 years, she was under the sway of a personality other than her husband's. Everything Tommy said to her became part of her forever. They drank the bottle of wine while a faint wind rocked the pine needles, and the sensuous heat of early afternoon made blinding freckles on the checkered luncheon cloth. Tommy came over behind her and laid his arms along hers, clasping her hands. Their cheeks touched, and then their lips, and she gasped, half with passion for him, half with the sudden surprise of its force. "Can't you send the governess and the children away for the afternoon? They have a piano lesson. Anyhow, I don't want to stay here. Kiss me again." A little later, riding toward Nice, she thought, "So I have white crook's eyes, have I? Very well, then, better a sane crook than a mad Puritan." His assertion seemed to absolve her from all blame or responsibility, and she had a thrill of delight in thinking of herself in a new way. New vistas appeared ahead, peopled with the faces of many men, none of whom she need obey or even love. She drew in her breath, hunched her shoulders with a wriggle, and turned to Tommy. "Have we got to go all the way to your hotel at Monte Carlo?" He brought the car to a stop with a squeak of tires. "No," he answered. "And my God, I have never been so happy as I am this minute." They had passed through Nice following the blue coast and begun to mount to the middling high corniche. Now Tommy turned sharply down to the shore, ran out a blunt peninsula, and stopped in the rear of a small shore hotel. Its tangibility frightened Nicole for a moment. At the desk, an American was arguing interminably with the clerk about the rate of exchange. She hovered, outwardly tranquil but inwardly miserable, as Tommy filled out the police blanks, his real, hers false. Their room was a Mediterranean room, almost ascetic, almost clean, darkened to the glare of the sea. Simplest of pleasures, simplest of places. Tommy ordered 2 cognacs, and when the door closed behind the waiter, he sat in the only chair, dark, scarred, and handsome, his eyebrows arched and upcurling, a fighting Puck, an earnest Satan. Before they had finished the brandy, they suddenly moved together and met, standing up. Then they were sitting on the bed, and he kissed her hardy knees. Struggling a little still, like a decapitated animal, she forgot about Dick and her new white eyes, forgot Tommy himself, and sank deeper and deeper into the minutes and the moment. When he got up to open a shutter and find out what caused the increasing clamor below their windows, his figure was darker and stronger than Dick's, with highlights along the rope twists of muscle. Momentarily, he had forgotten her, too. Almost in the second of his flesh breaking from hers, she had a foretaste that things were going to be different than she had expected. She felt the nameless fear which precedes all emotions, joyous or sorrowful, inevitable as a hum of thunder precedes a storm. Tommy peered cautiously from the balcony and reported, "All I can see is 2 women on the balcony below this. They're talking about weather and tipping back and forth in American rocking chairs."
"Making all that noise?"
"The noise is coming from somewhere below them. Listen."
"Oh, way down south in the land of cotton, hotels bum and business rotten, look away."
"It's Americans." Nicole flung her arms wide on the bed and stared at the ceiling. The powder had dampened on her to make a milky surface.
She liked the bareness of the room, the sound of the single fly navigating overhead. Tommy brought the chair over to the bed and swept the clothes off it to sit down. She liked the economy of the weightless dress and espadrilles that mingled with his ducks upon the floor. He inspected the oblong white torso, joined abruptly to the brown limbs and head, and said, laughing gravely, "You are all new, like a baby." With white eyes. "I'll take care of that." It's very hard taking care of white eyes, especially the ones made in Chicago. "I know all the old Languedoc peasant remedies." "Kiss me on the lips, Tommy." "That's so American," he said, kissing her nevertheless. "When I was in America last, there were girls who would tear you apart with their lips, tear themselves, too, until their faces were scarlet with the blood around the lips all brought out in a patch, but nothing further." Nicole leaned up on one elbow. "I like this room," she said. "I find it somewhat meager." "Darling, I'm glad you wouldn't wait until we got to Monte Carlo." "Why only meager? Why, this is a wonderful room, Tommy. Like the bare tables in so many Cezannes and Picassos."
"I don't know."
He did not try to understand her.
"There's that noise again. My God, has there been a murder?" He went to the window and reported once more. "It seems to be two American sailors fighting, and a lot more cheering them on. They are from your battleship offshore."
He wrapped a towel around himself and went farther out on the balcony.
"They have pools with them. I have heard about this now. The women follow them from place to place, wherever the ship goes. But what women? One would think with their pay they could find better women. Why, the women who followed Kornilov, why, we never looked at anything less than a ballerina."
Nicole was glad he had known so many women, so that the word itself meant nothing to him. She would be able to hold him so long as the person in her transcended the universals of her body.
"Hit him where it hurts." "Yeah. Hey, what'd I tell you, get inside that, right? Come on, Dolschmidt, your son. Yeah, 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 yeah."
Tommy turned away. "This place seems to have outlived its usefulness. You agree?" She agreed, but they clung together for a moment before dressing. And then, for a while longer, it seemed as good enough a palace as any. Dressing at last, Tommy exclaimed,
"My God, those two women in the rocking chairs on the balcony below us haven't moved. They're trying to talk this matter out of existence. They're here on an economical holiday, and all the American Navy and all the whores in Europe couldn't spoil it."
He came over gently and surrounded her, pulling the shoulder strap of her slip into place with his teeth. Then a sound split the air outside. Crack! Boom! It was the battleship, sounding a recall. Now, down below their window, it was pandemonium indeed, for the boat was moving to shores as yet unannounced. Waiters called accounts and demanded settlements in impassioned voices. There were oaths and denials, the tossing of bills too large and change too small. Pass-outs were assisted to the boats, and the voices of the naval police chopped with quick commands through all voices. There were cries, tears, shrieks, promises as the first launch shoved off and the women crowded forward on the wharf, screaming and waving. Tommy saw a girl rush out upon the balcony below, waving a napkin, and before he could see whether or not the rocking English women gave in at last and acknowledged her presence, there was a knock at their own door. Outside, excited female voices made them agree to unlock it, disclosing two girls, young, thin, and barbaric, unfound rather than lost, in the hall. One of them wept chokingly.
"Qui wave off your porch," implored the other in passionate American. "Qui please? Wave at the boyfriends? Qui please? The other rooms is all locked."
"With pleasure," Tommy said. The girls rushed out on the balcony, and presently their voices struck a loud treble over the din.
"Bye, Charlie! Charlie, look up! Send a wire, General Olivery, Nice! Charlie!"
He don't see me.
One of the girls hoisted her skirt suddenly, pulled and ripped at her pink step-ins, and tore them to a sizable flag. Then, screaming, "Ben! Ben!" she waved it wildly. As Tommy and Nicole left the room, it still fluttered against the blue sky. Oh, say, can you see the tender color of remembered flesh? While at the stern of the battleship arose in rivalry the Star-Spangled Banner. They dined at the new beach casino at Monte Carlo. Much later they swam in Beaulieu, in a roofless cavern of white moonlight formed by a circlet of pale boulders about a cup of phosphorescent water facing Monaco and the blur of Mentone. She liked his bringing her there to the eastward vision and the novel tricks of wind and water. It was all as new as they were to each other. Symbolically, she lay across his saddle bow as surely as if he had wolfed her away from Damascus and they had come out upon the Mongolian plain. Moment by moment, all that Dick had taught her fell away, and she was ever nearer to what she had been in the beginning, prototype of that obscure yielding up of swords that was going on in the world about her. Tangled with love in the moonlight, she welcomed the anarchy of her lover. They awoke together, finding the moon gone down and the air cool. She struggled up, demanding the time, and Tommy called it roughly at 3.
"I've got to go home, then. I thought we'd sleep in Monte Carlo. No, there's a governess and the children. I've got to roll in before daylight."
"As you like." They dipped for a second, and when he saw her shivering, he rubbed her briskly with a towel. As they got into the car with their heads still damp, their skins fresh and glowing, they were loath to start back. It was very bright where they were, and as Tommy kissed her, she felt him losing himself in the whiteness of her cheeks and her white teeth and her cool brow and the hand that touched his face. Still attuned to Dick, she waited for interpretation or qualification. But none was forthcoming. Reassured sleepily and happily that none would be, she sank low in the seat and drowsed until the sound of the motor changed and she felt them climbing toward Villa Diana. At the gate, she kissed him an almost automatic goodbye. The sound of her feet on the walk was changed. The night noises of the garden were suddenly in the past, but she was glad, nonetheless, to be back. The day had progressed at a staccato rate, and in spite of its satisfactions, she was not habituated to such strain.
This ends Disc 11.